This is Unpacking Design, a podcast to help designers of all kinds better themselves in career, business, and life. Join me, Mike LaValle, and my co-host, Tim Ong, as we unpack the problems designers face every day. Welcome to Season 2 of Unpacking Design, Life Lessons to My Younger Self. Each episode this season is a raw and unfiltered dive into what we wish we knew years ago. Since we can't turn back the clocks for ourselves, we hope that these masterclass discussions will help you on your own journey. Enjoy.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome back to Unpacking Design. You're listening to our 12-part series called Life Lessons to My Younger Self, where Tim and I each share six lessons we learned in our lives and our careers. Today, on my last lesson, I'll be discussing an epic and engaging lesson to my younger self. If there is one lesson I would teach my younger self, it's that empathy can be your superpower. Superheroes typically have a power or trait that makes them unique in the pantheon of other champions. Some heroes can fly. Some can see through walls, some can sense danger, some can run really fast, and some can lift heavy objects. Regardless of their individual power, though, a hero will typically use their fantastical ability to help others. I would argue that empathy is a superpower for the everyday person. Why? Empathy, what Oxford Dictionary describes as the ability to understand and share feelings of another, allows you to relate to other people in the most human of ways. This is important for several reasons, but mostly I believe it's important because fewer people in this world try to understand the vantage point of others that you might think. People are busy and selfish. I don't say that to mean that people don't care about others. Rather, humans can be self-absorbed in their own worlds, forgetting that everyone around them is dealing with their own issues as well. So Tim, in this last lesson, I kind of wanted to break down four separate mini lessons here and talk a little bit about and kind of break down the idea of empathy as a superpower that we can all have. So the first mini lesson in this series of four is that everyone has their own shit to deal with. So as a sort of mid-career project manager, I have the privilege to lead teams through design and construction of projects in my office. That means, though, that I have to play the role of leader, designer, coach, mentor, sounding board, and sometimes a shoulder to cry on. And there was once someone who worked on my team who never really seemed to click with what he was working on. He kept fumbling around deadlines, made mistakes, and was rarely present in his work. Something was disjointed and amiss. After a while, I had to step in and have a heart-to-heart, sort of an intervention, if you will. The setting was uncomfortable for everyone, and I simply told him that his work was slipping. Then I asked him, was there anything going on that he wanted to talk about? That was it. It was a small gesture to let him know that if he had something going on at home or otherwise, I was there to listen. As it turned out, a lot was happening in his life, and he was trying to figure it out all at the same time. Those challenges were weighing him down, and he recognized that they were, in turn, affecting the quality of his work. Before we had that conversation, I had no context of whether he was simply not working out as an employee or if there was something else unseen that was going on outside of the office. I'm not the human resources department in my office for sure, but I wanted to be there for him if he needed me to be. So, Tim, I know that you lead teams in your projects and you support those teams in your own ways. How do you personally work within your own teams to understand their struggles inside or outside the office? Do you get involved or do you have kind of a hands-off approach when it comes to personal connection?
I think for me, it was one of the biggest things that I struggled with because when I first started leading teams, the initial idea I had in my mind was that I needed to be able to tell people what to do. And immediately for me, that translated to, these are all the things we need to do for this project. Your role is this. You're going to do that, right? Like that was the initial thought in my head. And I remember I was going to approach my team and act in that way. But I took a step back and I asked myself, why is it that I believe that to be true? Why is it that I want to show up and actually tell people what to do and dictate the work? And the answer to that question was that everyone that I learned from, all the project managers I've had, all the project architects I've worked with, all of the people who were supposedly above me in that sense, they were all in this place where they would dictate the work to people. And they would always delegate because someone in the office or someone in project manager for architecture school told them or taught them through their actions that they had to delegate once they reached a certain level. And what that meant to them was, I need to just tell people what to do. I don't tell them how. I don't tell them why. I don't ask questions. So I took a step back. And when I realized that that was the reason why I thought that way, I changed it up. And for me, when I have to lead any projects in my office, the first thing I do is I look at the project and understand what it is I'm about to do. Is it a project that's failing, that's ready in the middle of its design? Or is it a brand new project that I'm leading from start to finish? If it's a project that's failing, I make a bold move and I figure out why it's failing. If it's because of the current team that's in place, I figure out who or what was the issue. And then I cut those things out of the team. I had to do it recently and it was a terrible feeling, but it was the only way we would have attained the success that the project deserved. And we had to let go of the people in the team. And by letting go, I mean transition them to different projects. And then I put together a new team. And the first thing we did was we met and we talked through the project. We talked about where it was. We talked about all the issues around it, the client relationships, the struggles people had. And then we simply looked at each other and asked very bold questions. What is it that we need to do in order to finish this? How do we actually get to the point where the project is in good hands? How do we get to a point where most of us can step out? And the moment we started asking these questions, more and more people started chiming in. And I started to realize that for me, it's something that I love to do. I like to guide conversations through questions. Because the more questions you ask, the more information you'll get from all the people on the team. And as I started doing that, I realized that each person, because they answered the question, started to take on ownership. When you tell someone to do something, they don't feel like they own it. When you ask them a question and they respond and they say, I can take this on. I can do it. I can do it by this date. They usually take it on wholeheartedly because they've committed themselves to doing that work. And so for me, when I lead teams now, I wouldn't say it's a hands-off approach at all. It's a very in-depth discussion in the beginning so that as we go through the project, we all can just rely on each other when needed. Other than that, there's only the typical meetings we'll hold. I hate weekly meetings. I love having bi-weekly or monthly. I don't like having meetings where people show up and all these people say is, hey, there's really nothing new to talk about, but I just wanted to get everyone together and just take up your time and waste your life. That's not really how I think meetings should be held. But that's something that we're starting to see more of in the corporate environment. So for me, I also cut all the team meetings out. I only have team meetings when I feel that they're necessary. And if I don't feel like it's necessary, I don't push it. So for me, I don't step back until I feel that everyone is comfortable. And then I make sure that I'll touch base with each person, especially the younger people who might be afraid to be the ones to reach out. I reach out to them, make sure they're in good hands, ask them any questions, let them ask me questions back, guide them as much as I could, and let them go. So.
Yeah, I really like that. I can tell that we have similar but different styles in the way that we kind of approach team building and say working with people on a team. And I think it's great because it brings two sides. I don't want to say two sides of the coin, but it brings two perspectives to the table that I think are really important. I think if I was to summarize a little bit, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, Tim, you're saying that you kind of, I guess, connect with everybody initially, make sure that your team is the right fit for the team. And then as you go forward, sort of connect with them individually to make sure that that relationship is sustained, that they feel comfortable and that they are sort of moving in the right direction. Whereas maybe I would take the position where maybe I don't always have the choice of, or I haven't pushed to have a specific choice of who's on my team. So I kind of work within the idea that, okay, these are the people that I have to work with around me. And this is the team that I have. It's they have their skills that they can work within. And then they have their stuff that might be going on behind the scenes that might affect that work. And I will have those similar kind of powwows in the beginning, but I think as the project goes on, I'm more of a fix it when I notice things are going awry versus checking in maybe more frequently. Does that sound like a good summary, or would you change anything about what I said?
Yeah, I don't think that for me, it's that I just focus purely on a relationship. When I'm developing the team dynamic, it's about getting people to own up to the work and the responsibilities that they sign up for. So I understand all the different roles. I understand where people want to grow. And then I let them take on those tasks and I guide them into areas that they haven't done before. And through that simple logic, as people get more and more comfortable and they feel like they're growing and they feel like they have ownership, somehow I found that all the projects I've run in that way will end up being successful because everybody knows what part of it they owned and each person knows who they need to talk to if they are slowing them down.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Before we move on to the second mini lesson, I kind of wanted to have a little bit of a sub discussion here or a follow-up to sort of the initial story that I had. So we were just talking about kind of this scenario where I've had members on my team before where they have stuff that's going on in their own lives and it starts to affect the work. I know that there's something going on. It's not, you can tell that the mood has changed or the dynamic has changed. And I think that there's a difference between somebody reacting at work and just getting mad, right? And just getting frustrated or upset or sad or disappointed or happy. And there's highs and there's lows. But I would say that there's actually a very recent example that happened to me the other day. Somebody who was in my leadership got kind of snarky at my office. And it was kind of out of the blue. It was not in their sort of normal set of personality traits, I would consider. It was kind of abnormal. And I took it as, it wasn't even in person. It was like through an email. It just had that kind of like extra sarcastic sassiness to it in the tone of the email. And aside from the fact that text is sometimes hard to decipher, I just got the sense that something was kind of happening behind the scenes. And I thought to myself, I don't know what's happening with that person's day to day. I don't work on all of the same projects that they do. But I just got the sense that I'm just going to let it go. Cause the email was not necessarily directed to me, but it was directed to something that I was working on. And I felt like just as with the situation I was kind of uncovering with this other person I was working with on my own team, somebody, it works both ways, I guess is ultimately what I'm getting at. It works out across all different kinds of people. But I think that there's the difference between like daily things that are happening and patterns that I notice in people over time. So this person that I had this kind of intervention with, I had to have the intervention because the work was suffering to the point where the project wasn't happening properly. And we needed to sort of reconfigure how we were doing it. And like you said, Tim, set those expectations again. Maybe they were lost along the way or they were misremembered or whatever. The goal wasn't really in the same place anymore. And I don't know if it's just my personality type that I have sort of a drive to keep pushing. But I remember going through my own set of burnout a couple of years ago and knowing that I had my own shit to deal with. But I remember clearly, maybe I wasn't at the 100%, you know, go-getter mic level, but I was definitely doing my job and I was definitely showing up and trying to make sure that everything was going smoothly and being there. Not everybody can do that all the time, but I guess I just wanted to break down, how do you deal with people on kind of a day-to-day, if they're working through, you know, you can like tell, you can tell when somebody's off or having just a day. How do you deal with those kind of moments to moments? I think you were talking a little bit more broadly about project goals, but how do you deal with the sort of short-term thing?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because when I was traveling a lot for work, I saw another project manager do this. And I also saw a partner at the office do this in the past, where if you can sense that someone is going through something and that something is stopping them from being able to focus, you can ask them a simple question. And this is what I've started to do. I'll ask a question like, hey, something doesn't seem right today. Do you want to talk about anything? And if they're like, oh, you know, I'm just, and they usually let you know. They'll let you know what it is and how deep it is, how big the impact is on their life. When that happens, I tend, if it's a project that I'm leading with them, to let them know that they can go home for the day and come back when they're feeling better. And I know that if by doing that, if someone ever came up to me like a partner and they were like, Tim, you can't just do that because time is money and this and that. To me, it just doesn't make sense to let somebody work on a project when they're not in the right mind to do it, because the work that they do might actually be detrimental to the project. Instead, I'd rather that they focus on their mental health, get better, recoup, come back when they can, and then focus with the team at their 100%. Because most of the time we hold things in, especially in the design fields, because we don't want people to know that we're weak for some reason. Like, mental health is equated to weakness. And that's something that we need to start breaking. So for me, the whole idea about empathy being your superpower is important here, because when you can sense someone needs some help, or you can sense that someone just needs a day off, you give them that day off. And I learned that when I was traveling and working directly with the owner of the practice, where there was a day where my foot swelled in size. There was no way I was going to be on a construction site because I couldn't even walk. And I remember sending a note to my team that included him as well. And as soon as I did that, I told them all, I said, hey, I'm going to book a flight back because I need to get my foot checked out. The only thing that they said was, take care of yourself. Do anything you need to do. Take whatever taxis you need to take. Take whatever flight you need to get on, and cancel your hotel if that's what you need to do. I did it. And then they were just checking in and asking me how things were going. Is everything fine? It didn't even come down to, well, you had to take the day off. You had to do this emergency thing or whatever. It was, hey, you need to take care of yourself. Then get back out there when you can. That was it. And that taught me that I need to make sure that I do the same for other people. If you're hurt, if you're going through something, then you need that time to yourself. You have to take it. So when I can sense someone needs it, I give it to them, because if I don't do that, it might actually lead to the project suffering and eventually fail.
Yeah, I really like that. I think that there's an ever-growing sort of community of, I don't want to just say it's limited to creatives. I think a lot of people are starting to almost sort of unpack for themselves the idea that mental health is also physical health, and that sometimes we just need, just like you would need if you had the flu or you had a cold or you had something that you were coming down with, you know, as a physical illness, or you got hurt or injured, you have to also be cognizant of the times that you need to give yourself sort of a mental day, a day to just give in to the fact that you're human, I think is kind of another way to think about it. Is we all have these kind of issues to deal with, and sometimes they are emotionally driven. Sometimes they are because we're overwhelmed or we feel fatigued mentally and psychologically. And sometimes there are people with actually, you know, real sort of categorical psychological conditions. And I think that those kinds of scenarios require us to have, and I think having gone through burnout myself and having gone through something that was that significant has helped me really rein in my own empathy. And I think that's one of the reasons why I wanted to talk about it today, because I think it's an important topic to broach here. I want to touch on one other little thing that you said there that I think is important is people don't want to appear weak in our profession, in our industry. And I would broaden our kind of bubble here that we're talking about, not just in architecture. I think it happens in almost all creative fields where we want to feel like we are, and maybe beyond creative fields, maybe everybody, but we all want to feel like we're important, like we're part of the path forward in a project or towards a goal. And I think it's important to just consider the fact that we don't all have to be perfect. And that sometimes empathy is about understanding that the other person might be dealing with stuff. And I think that helps you connect with the other person because then they can understand and can feel like when you ask those questions, Tim, and you're trying to understand in the moment if somebody needs your help, that probably means a lot to that person on the other end, that you give enough of a crap to talk to them about it and to work through that with them. And yeah, I don't really have much more to say on that topic, but I just thought it was an important point. So I want to move on to the second mini lesson here. So if the first mini lesson is that everyone has their own shit to deal with, I think the second thing that I would talk about in terms of making empathy your superpower is I found the way you react to someone will make you a leader, a follower, or a roadblock. And I'm going to break each of these down because they're not really terms that they're terms that I kind of have come up with here based on remembering my interactions with people over time. So in my mind, a leader in any setting has to make decisions based on the resources at their disposal and the task at hand. Sometimes a problem will arise from a team member that throws everything off that was planned before that moment. A deadline has to shift, a project needs to be reshuffled, more help is required to hit a milestone. Leaders react to problems that arise by empathizing with their team, trying to understand how to better help them function at their best, and supporting them when they need it. A follower doesn't require the same amount of empathy as a leader does in order to do their job. They're a support member of the team or group, but it's not necessary for them to be 100% in tune with the issues of their fellow followers that their fellow followers face. When a change is made by the leader, a follower follows in line. A roadblock, however, places themselves into situations they don't have any business in. They quote unquote know everything and disregard the feelings of others. They become an obstacle to the mission of the team and the health and well-being of its members. In this way, empathy, slowing down to understand someone else's point of view, can give you the advantage on a team because it immediately places you into a position of power and influence. You can understand the landscape of your team and assess who should be able to take on a task or a project at any given time. It helps you keep a pulse on the general mental state of your team as well. Is your team sad? Are they generally in good spirits? Do they need a bit of a break from crunching because of a recent deadline? So, Tim, and we've started to dissect this and unpack this a little bit already, but for me, empathy increases my ability to lead the team I'm working with, trying to keep a cool head and consider how much influence another person has on the success or failure of a project commensurate with their role. Do you consider the individual roles of the people who support you in the context of how much empathy you should give them? So maybe to simplify that, if you're leading a team and you have somebody in a drafter type role, a role that is really just to create documents, does that person require more or less the same empathy as somebody who might be figuring out problems, solving them, leading a team as a more senior person?
The way that I approach it, I've always thought about it as if I'm working with anyone on any project, whether or not I'm leading the team as a manager or just being the architect and assisting wherever needed and helping others, then for me, I always approach everyone in the same way, whether it's the owner of the business or the project manager above me, the seniors, if it's the people who are seen to be at the levels below me, I always approach each of them from the perspective of, back when I was in their shoes, this is how I felt. And the reason why I say that is because it lets me try and put myself into the perspective of theirs so that I can see the ways that I can talk to them, and I can identify the questions that should be asked in order for them to feel comfortable and for them to feel like they're growing and for them to feel like they're gaining something from this experience with me. If it's the owner of the business, I can't put myself in his shoes or her shoes immediately because I haven't been in that position. So for me, I still approach it the same way. It's about knowing them as a person and trying to understand what their goals are and what they're trying to do in their lives and what they might be going through. And then asking them the same kinds of questions. And generally for me, when I look at it in that way, it doesn't matter if they're the draftsperson. It doesn't matter if they're the new intern. If they want to join a project and they want to learn how to manage, and that's what they say, I let them start to lead consultant team meetings and I let them take that on and I jump in if they feel like they need some assistance. But the other thing is this, that if I know someone wants to learn a skill that they don't know yet, like working with consultants and being part of that discussion and leading it, because as the architects, we generally are the ones leading those discussions. I usually will let the people who are at the meeting know that this person is new to this process and I'm going to let them try and run the meeting. And if any questions come up, don't hesitate to ask that person. You can find in that one moment, just by saying that out loud, that others in the room switched the ways they would have talked. They actually want to help the person grow. And a lot of times, it seems as if in the design professions, we don't want to say things like that. Hey, I'm new to this. Can you guide me as I'm going? This is my first time leading a meeting like this. And I want to give all of you as much information as I can. But again, this is my first time. So if you can just bear with me and guide me in any ways that is needed, I would really appreciate it. Just by saying that one thing, you can feel the dynamic of a room change. Because people always want to help. And if they don't want to help, then no, they shouldn't have been your consultants in the first place. Find a new firm to work with. So for me, it all comes down to putting myself in different perspectives and approaching those discussions from that perspective.
Yeah, I really like that because I think one of the things that I was drawn to that you said the most, and it's something I've talked about a little bit kind of off of this discussion, is that idea of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes, right? And I think I might have asked the question in not the way that I had intended. So when I was breaking down kind of the types of people that I see, you know, across a team or across an organization, the leader, the follower, the roadblock, I think of it more as, because I should have known, of course, that you would probably say, Tim, that you would want to deal with everybody equally and try to empathize with them and put yourself in their place, right? But I guess what I should have asked, maybe in a different way, is have you ever experienced somebody who is not maybe more of in that roadblock position where they don't want your help, they don't care if you care, they want to do it their way, and how do you work with those people versus the kind of maybe more understanding or the more engaged person who does want to lead those meetings? Maybe they're a younger staff member and they really do want to be part of the process. I feel like sometimes experience and time makes people either more generous with their time and their help for a process or a team, or it takes them the other way and gives them less empathy because they just know everything. So how might you work with somebody like that?
I actually choose not to. And I'm just going to be very bold and blunt and say it that way. I've had someone above me and I'll say it in this way. There was a gentleman in the office and he needed assistance on a project. The person here is generally the person that everyone needs to go to at some point to ask questions related to something very specific. When people go to him, everyone who goes to him hates going to him. Why is that? Because he knows so much, but he tries to be Socrates. He tries to guide you through questions when his role is supposed to be to give you the direct answer to the question you've asked. For example, an email that should be something like, hey, how tall can this building be? Right? Something that you can find in a code book or something. And the back and forth might actually take you a month with this person. And so instead of going to that person, everyone goes to other people and try and circumvent going to that person. The reason why that person is the way that they are is because they've discovered that by doing what they do, they can waste time. And to me, time is the most precious commodity that I don't have to waste. And so when I had this one interaction with this person, I remember sitting there and I was like, hey, I'm assisting with this project because it was failing. So they called me in to help with it. I remember sitting at a meeting and I had done all this work. For some reason, this person was having a bad day. And being one of the only minorities in the office, I hate when people do this one thing. So we sat there and he asked this question, but he said it because he was trying to be snarky. It was something as simple as a grammatical correction to a call out for a detail, right? And all that needed to be said was, hey, we should probably say it this way. Instead, it led to, all architects should know that they need to do this. No one should have to tell any architect. And I was like, wait, what? What are you saying? Then he went on to repeat it again, but louder. And I cut him mid-sentence and I said, stop. And he tried to finish and I said, stop. And I let the air fill with silence and he turned red. And as soon as he was done, I said, look, I've gone through all the same steps that you did to get a license. I don't need to hear this and I don't need to hear it now. You can finish the project on your own. I left. I had a meeting with the partners at the office. They called them in for a meeting and I have not worked with them since. So for me, there are certain people that you just can't work with. It's not that you can't work with them, Mike, but I can't work with them. Maybe you love working with someone who is in that sense of mind that all of you love to commiserate and waste time, but I don't. So when I meet those people, no matter what role you're at, if I don't vibe with you because you don't want to give respect, I'm not going to work with you. It's like saying that you go to work at a place, and this also exists, and it's something we should talk more about in the future. It's like working at a place within a design profession, which in a lot of scenarios is still a predominantly white male-owned business practice, especially architecture. And you go and you work at a place where there is only one minority among 100. And no one actually understands that the things that they've grown used to saying and doing are not actually right to say or do with certain people. And so when you start to meet these kinds of people and you don't know how to change your perspective and respect other people, then it's not worth working with those particular teams. So for me, if I ever encounter someone and I know that I can't work with them, I make it clear and I never work with them again. And if it leads to me not being able to work with anyone at my office, then it might be me. It might be that I'm actually the guy that no one wants to work with. And if that's the case, then I need to move on. But ultimately, that one decision I made that day helped me stay focused on not being in a toxic environment and also focusing on getting better at becoming the person I want to be as an architect and standing up for myself. So I wouldn't ever try and force myself to do anything with a roadblock person. If they're a roadblock, roadblocks are there for a reason. They're there to stop people. I'm going to circumvent that person and find my next path.
Yeah, I appreciate you sharing that, Tim, because I think that there have definitely been people in my career, in my life, you know, whether it's outside the office or inside the office, that I do try to at least initially empathize with. You know, I will give them the benefit of the doubt at least, you know, once or twice to say, look, I don't understand where you're coming from. Let me try to understand you. You probably had those conversations with the person you described before the story that you said, just trying to do what you would normally do as you've described it before, just trying to get to know who they are, where they're coming from, all that jazz. And I think that there just comes a moment where you definitely recognize that you are either one personality type and they're another, or they have decided for whatever reason that they know more than you do. And it doesn't matter what you say, they will just always be that way. That roadblock for me is just an indicator that not everyone, it's not our job to change people in an office setting or in life, right? It's not, and you shouldn't try, because somebody is on their own journey. They're doing their own thing. You can empathize with them. You can understand where they're coming from. And maybe you can have a conversation that might shift their mindset, but you're not going to change a person's whole life. And you're not going to change how that person that you told the story about interacts with other people unless they realize it for themselves that that's not the way to be, or that's not the way to talk to people. The one thing that I think it's interesting to me, because when I think about the way that certain roadblocks have been presented in my career, I think back to similar kinds of stories that you had, Tim, but I would just commend you on like really standing your ground in those situations, because I don't think I necessarily did that. I think the way for me to get around those people or circumvent them was actually just to, in some ways, this is going to sound conceited a little bit, and I don't mean it this way, but to do a job so well that the people who are working with you, they want to work with you, and that the leadership at your office or whoever is above you recognizes what you're doing and puts you with other people that will also work well with you, so that they gain more and more traction from that, the high quality of work that you're doing. So I think for me, that's worked for me. And I think for you, it's been just to literally cut the roadblocks out entirely. For me, the roadblocks kind of fade, become team members on other teams, and I don't deal with those people anymore. I just have conversations with leadership sort of in more casual ways from time to time and say, look, I jive with these people and they work better with me. But anyway, I digress. So I want to move on to the third mini lesson here. And I think that this one's going to be an interesting one. I actually have it in sort of two subcategories here, but the mini lesson is essentially not everyone cares about the same things you do. And I actually almost considered this to be one of my overall lessons to myself, but I felt like it kind of worked within this idea of empathy. So I want to break it down into two categories. First is ambition, and the second is sort of a hobbies and interests. And the first part, ambition, I found out the hard way that not everyone thinks the way that I do. I'm a driven person with many ambitious goals for my life. For many years, I made architecture the only focus in my life. The people around me weren't always bad people by any means. They just were not interested in architecture the way I was, and they were interested in more than just that. And some people punched in at 9 a.m. and out again at 5 p.m. They had priorities beyond just work and made it well known that that was the case. And don't get me wrong, Tim, a lot of people do that, and they show up and they are well, they work well within their time period and they leave, and it's a good mental health boundary. That's not what I mean when I say that. I mean it more like some people see their position as just a job, and others see their position as a career or a passion or something that they really want to do for the rest of their lives. And I feel very fortunate in my life that I have had that ambition and that drive to make architecture in this portion of my career that passion, right? And that I am very driven to show up every day and create architectural designs, to work with people, to work within the profession, and do, I might not like everything, but I love architecture in general. So I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about how empathy, I've had to learn the hard way, I guess, that I am one type of person and that there are other people at the office. In every job I've ever worked in, there are people like me who Tim, I would probably say that you're very similar in that way, where you have your own motivations and drives to do a good job, and that you're trying to build skills and learn more things as you go and become a better architect overall. And then there are other people who they like learning. They're okay with learning. They're okay with building skills, but they just kind of, it's a job to them. It's not more than that. It's not less than that. It just is. And I don't know if you've struggled with relating to people in that way. I've struggled for most of my life to connect to people in that way, where I don't understand that. I guess it's the way that I'm wired. I've always been sort of that way. I can remember distinctly back in middle school, I realized that I had to make sure that certain grades and certain classes were top notch, and that I was going to put myself on a trajectory. And I had all these career steps, and, you know, on and on and on. And I wanted to build this life for myself. And I felt like the one way to do that was to keep motivated and push myself. And I don't know if you've had difficulty relating to, well, first, I'm just going to confirm here. Would you say that you are a driven person? And if so, do you find it difficult to empathize or relate to other people who aren't?
I don't see myself as a driven person. People tell me I am, because the things that I do, I now just see them as hobbies. So I don't know if that answers both of those questions, but that would be my answer.
Yeah. Okay. I would definitely call you a driven person. I guess to go from there, then I've just had a difficult time trying to understand how, I had put architecture at the forefront of my life for a long time, and I had difficulty understanding how people had other interests outside of the office. And not to say that I don't. I like video games. I like superhero stuff. I like reading. I like all sorts of different things, drawing. And I think that there's just this way of operating that I had basically until I hit burnout a couple of years ago. And then it kind of unlocked this idea that, oh, I can actually be a human being outside of that. So, okay, well, we'll move on to the second topic. The one thing I did want to talk about, and maybe this relates a little bit more, Tim, to what you were going to talk about, was hobbies and interests. Some people love sports. Others, like me, could care less on most day about sports. I mean, we live in Buffalo, New York, Tim, but I'm a bandwagon fan at best. I prefer things like video games and reading self-development books. For that matter, many people don't like to read at all. And I just, that's, it is what it is. I heard a statistic the other day that may or may not surprise you, that 55% of adults don't finish one book per year. They read less than one book per year. And it just threw me for a loop. But I think of the ways that we can empathize with other people who have completely different interests than us. And it comes from a book that I read last year. I think you've read this as well, Tim, How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. And essentially what it comes down to are these themes or these lessons that Dale sort of breaks down in the book. And one of them is to talk in terms of the other person's interest. And I think of it as having empathy for what people are interested in, whether that be working on their interests outside of work, or trying to figure out what motivates them as people. If you know that someone else likes the same things that I do, I can relate them to go deeper. I can have better conversations on those topics. If I know that somebody doesn't like those things, I can switch the topics to something that they do like. This makes them feel more comfortable in the discussion and helps them contribute to that dialogue as well. As I've said, Tim, I've struggled most of my life to connect with people because I've often tried to compare my motivations and my interests to theirs. Maybe driven is not the right word, but I think that you're a self-motivated person and that you have interests that once you find them, you tend to, I would say it's it's fair to say that you go kind of all into them, or you really try to dive deep into the topics that you that do interest you. Does this change how you interact with people? Do you find that you are sharing those interests with more people as you go, or do you find that you, maybe some of your interests don't click with people and you find difficulty having those kinds of conversations?
I'm actually going to switch the question up just a little bit, because I think it relates back to what you're trying to get at with the first part of this mini lesson here. The first part was about ambition and this idea of really going all in for the things you love. And when you look at other people not doing something similar at the same pace that you perceive yourself doing it, you all of a sudden start to judge and say, well, why aren't they doing more? Why aren't they doing more? And I think that's something that that's driven by design schools, that we're always trying to do better, 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 perfect, 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 that we never actually take a moment to ask ourselves the one thing that I started to find later in my career. And it was, why do people need to try and be the best designer or architect that they want to be? And even in the question, there's a word that implies that you're assuming that they want to be the best designer. Not everyone wants to be the best designer. I went to school with people that had so much architecture in their blood. Like that's all they, right? Like they would drink energy drinks all day. They were the Monster, the Red Bull. They would stack them into pyramids and they would claim that as their prize at the end of the year and say, look, I drank 365 Red Bulls, you know? And so those people had the biggest, brightest, best design creative projects that you could ever think of. When they graduated, a year later, they had children, they have a wife, they have a husband, they have people that they care about, they have a nice family, they have a regular house, like regular people. And those people that I once admired and looked at their creative work, I stopped admiring them for their work, but instead I started admiring them for finding what they truly wanted in life. And it was a family. So everyone has these different buckets, whether it's your hobby, your interest, your ambition, whatever it is. You would never know that those people wanted to just have a good, happy family. That architecture is second. Being a job that they can earn a good living from, that can help them do what they want to do. It was just their second thing. Their primary thing has always been family. Then you have people like us, Mike, the people that are like, I want to find what I'm supposed to do in my life, what I'm meant to do, what it is that I wake up to do, and how to make a living doing that thing. And you consistently work towards this blurry vision, trying to make it clear. You wipe your eyes every day. You just keep going and going and going, but you never actually figure it out. You just keep going. And when you look around you, you see the people who aren't moving at your pace. You're like, you're five coffees in your day, and you're looking at someone who's just sitting on a park bench watching birds. And you're like, wow, that person is not doing anything with their life, right? Interestingly enough, for me, when I see those people, I actually admire that they can sit there and spend time thinking, because I'm starting to really enjoy sitting down in my patio, looking at my backyard and just thinking and letting my mind do nothing just for 30 minutes and accepting that that's fine. And so when we talk about interacting with people and seeing these different approaches to life and trying to empathize, the one thing I've always done in my life that I'm so happy I still do is that I always ask all the people that I know this simple question, and it's about their life. I always ask, after work, how do you spend your evenings and your weekends? What do you love to do? Most of the time, it comes down to Netflix, or it comes down to Hulu or something, just like just to relax and unwind from a busy day. And you start to find that most people just love to chill. And that is not a bad thing. But then you add in another part to it. Well, when you are just relaxing in the evenings and on weekends, who are you with? What are you doing when you're doing those things? Are you cooking? Are you listening to music? Are you thinking about the next trip you want to go on, the next vacation? Where do you want to go? And as you start to ask these questions and people start to dig deeper, you start to find that there are different interests that they have that actually align with the same kind of ambitions that you have. They might love watching documentaries because there's something about the things that they're watching that's teaching them something about their life. And so it taught me to empathize in that way, that everyone has something that they want to do with their free time, which is ironic because your free time is when you are literally free from working for someone else, from working on a project. It's just the time that you have to spend. And how people spend it to us shouldn't be a way that we judge them. If someone wants to just chill, then it's fine. Let me know if I can join whenever I need some time to chill too. And so it took a while to get to that level of acceptance. I used to always struggle with accepting that people could do that, because I always thought people had to keep going. But these days, everyone has a different ambition in their life. And as long as you can identify what it is and see why it's so important to them, you'll eventually be able to understand who they are, what they're about, and appreciate them for what they want to be in their life.
Yeah, I'm glad that you went on and talked about some of those things, Tim, because I think there's a lot to unpack there. Two or three things I want to talk about. The first is, I think you put it really well, where it's kind of about this acceptance of almost, I think you were right in saying that we are sort of fed this story or this idea of being the best designer in school. And I took that hook, line, and sinker as a student. I was like, I need to be, maybe not Frank Gehry, but I need to be somebody important, right? I need to be somebody special. Like, there's this energy that kind of comes with, it might have also been the program that I went to. So if I went to Syracuse University for my architecture degree, and while I do believe that everybody there is a human being, there is sometimes an air when you go to a place like that, that, you know, they know that they're one of the best schools in the country. You know, they're very, very cognizant of that. They're very aware of that. And there are some people that take that to heart. And there are some people that just, like you said, Tim, maybe their interests are to help other people or to have a passion that isn't just being the best. But sometimes it's hard to know who's who in that kind of setting. And I don't mean that in a bad way. I just mean that in the sense that when I realized I was kind of on this path of that I'd set for myself, I had done all the right things, right? I had done the schoolwork to get me to that school for college. I had done really well in college after turning that passion for architecture into something that kind of lit me up and motivated me to do better and made me want to be sort of this ambitious person that I think I continue to, you know, to become over time. And I think that that fueled me to, for a long time. And one of the reasons why I wanted to kind of come to this lesson in the first place, Tim, and we haven't talked too much about this, but I was kind of an ass as a kid in college and directly after that, where I was kind of full of myself. I thought that people that, you know, didn't want to do exactly the same things that I want to do were wasting their time and that there was something wrong with them. And, you know, I don't think that way at all anymore. And I think that that's part of growing up. It's part of becoming an adult and realizing that other people have other interests and other motivations for their life, right? Like, not everybody has to be the same person that you see in the magazines or you see. Even, you know, we think about like people who are famous for being movie stars or for being famous authors or politicians or whoever, and they have this level of notoriety and fame. And while I think it's inherently human to want to be, let's say, not admired, but to be in favor with other people, I don't think that it's necessarily a good driving motivation and one that's kind of it becomes very shallow, and it became shallow for me as well. I think the only reason why I didn't kind of implode in my early years of my career was that I have also had a pretty good helping of wanting to, as a personality trait, of wanting to teach and help other people. And I think that that has overcome that ambition in the sense that I need to have formed this legacy and formed this, like, you know, notoriety and fame for myself, as much as I need to really now in this point in my life, and kind of what you were hinting at before, Tim, where people are finding the things that light them up. I'm finding that helping other people and being of service to other people, whether that's through design and creating things or teaching and mentoring, has really become one of the things that matters most to me in my life. Like, I really want to just keep doing this, and whatever that means, that's what I want to do. But I do think that there is this ambition that was driven into me and that I drove forward for myself because of the way that I thought everybody had to be in architecture and design. Everybody needs to be the best. And why aren't we all trying to be the best? And if we're all trying to be the best, who is the best? You know, you start asking these like cyclical questions that don't make any sense at some point. And there's that part of it. And I think it's really important for my younger self to know that empathy is a superpower, because it's something that will help you kind of get around that. I think if I had more empathy in college, as an example, I would have come to this realization of just letting, you know, if I want to be that person on the park bench, you know, feeding birds and thinking about whatever, then that's okay. You know, I don't have to use every second of every day in like this very efficient manner where all I'm doing is building a legacy for myself. Like, that does not have to be how I spend my life as a human being. I think the other thing that you were talking a little bit about here, Tim, is something that I've been listening to and experiencing in this writing course that I'm actually taking as we're recording this. So the professor, I guess, as you would call him, is Joshua Fields Milburn, who's one of the minimalists. And he's, you know, a prolific writer. He's been in documentaries. He's made a lot of content. He has a podcast, all that jazz. And he said something that I thought was really interesting that kind of comes back to relating to other people when you think about how people like different things and they do different things and they are different things. He doesn't ask this kind of question, what do? When you go to like a cocktail party or you're introduced for somebody for the first time, he doesn't ask, what do? Because that implies this idea of, oh, well, I'm associating your value or your worth with a job or an occupation, right? He asks a question similar to what you asked, Tim, which is, what are you passionate about? And if somebody asks him, for example, what do? He'll be like, well, I'm passionate about writing. And he talks about how he is not trying to associate himself with the noun, but more of the verb, more of the action, more of the thing, the process that he likes to cultivate for himself, to work on for himself. He loves writing, right? He likes to be a writer, but he more than that likes writing. And I think that in that same way, I think about how people can be motivated and be interested in lots of different things that have nothing to do with what they are as a job, as a 9-to-5 person. Like, Tim, I know that you enjoy many things beyond architecture. And if I asked you, what are you passionate about? That would be a different thing than if I asked you, what do? You might have a completely different conversation that if you ask, what do? It might be a very stagnant, very typical conversation where everybody falls in line and you talk about a job that you have and it's not as interesting. But there's something about what you're passionate about. What do you care about? You know, what are you interested in? What motivates you, or what do you, I really like the way that you put it, Tim, where you said, what do you like to do kind of in your free time? And it's not really a question, more as just kind of an idea there, but I didn't know if you wanted to say anything else before we move on to the last minute.
No, the only thing I wanted to say is just that the question that I asked is, what do you like to do in the evenings and on the weekends? Because it comes down to the actions that someone actually takes. Most people can tell you what they think they're passionate about, but I actually don't think people know what they're passionate about. A majority of the people that you might ask that question to, maybe 50% of the world doesn't actually know what they're passionate about because they haven't taken the actions that help them clarify what those passions are. You need to take action in order to clarify the passion. So when you ask someone what they're doing in their time after work, evenings, weekends, free time, that usually helps you identify what they actually are passionate about. They're a movie person. They love watching Netflix. They're a gamer. They're, you know, and to be able to accept it wholeheartedly and say, oh, wow, that's cool. Tell me more about gaming. What game do you like to play and why? Oh, you like first-person shooters. What is it about that experience? And to just dig deeper, then you start to find that you could actually help them identify that their passion is gaming, but specifically it's this, this, or that. And so for me, I do it because it's an exercise that helps me reflect it on myself. How am I spending my time in comparison to theirs? And what is it that I can identify for myself? There was also another item that came out of the discussion, another idea that I just wanted to mention, and we can move on. It's this idea that we're so quick to judge people about how they spend their time and what they say yes or no to. When in reality, even the people who are the most ambitious, who have passion, who have all these things, even they are on a path that others won't agree with. The most ambitious people that we know might be pursuing something at such a crazy high level, but to someone who doesn't really care about that, like someone who is not pursuing something, and to them, their pursuit is just their family, they might look at that ambitious person and say, why would you do all that? I think you should be focusing on your family, you know? And so it comes down to even a more recent event where Mike is very ambitious. You're constantly pursuing the book now. You're constantly taking these educational courses and learning how to do it better. That even when I ask you, hey, I see an opportunity where you can start helping more people on an app like Clubhouse, or hey, I see an opportunity where you can do this. Are you interested? I see this opportunity where you can be at this event. Are you interested? And each time I asked, you said, no, 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 no. In that very moment, I could have been the person that said, well, you're not ambitious enough, because if you were, you would drop everything and you would do this thing, right? But to me, I said, well, I know what he's all about. Right now, it's writing. So it makes sense. He doesn't want to do this thing. So I accept it and I just find other people. So in that sense, when you can accept something and accept people for who they are and what they choose to do, you'll find that when you're on this journey at such a high pace that you're moving like this Formula One racer car in your mind because you perceive yourself doing that much stuff, that ultimately, if all you do is that and you look at everyone else and say, they're not at my level, they're not at my level, they're too slow, I'm too fast, that by the end of that race, you will be by yourself. But if you're going down that road and you can identify those people that really jive with you because they're doing something at their pace, but they do something so wholeheartedly and you're able to accept that about them, then by the end of that race that you're running in this game called life, you'll end up with so many people who love you for who you are and support you for you because you did it for them first.
Yeah, that's very well said. I think something that you touched on a little bit, and we've talked a lot about before on other discussions, other conversations, and we talk about it a lot actually, is this idea of what a side hustle really means too. And I think of, we have these interests, we have these passions, we have these ways of trying to unlock these passions. I like the way that you said that. So that maybe people don't know what they're passionate about, but they might take a hobby or something like that and really be interested in it. Some people think that they need to make that into a side hustle or something else. And the reason why I'm bringing this up kind of before we move on is just because I think sometimes people can skew in their own minds the difference between just having something that they're passionate about, something that they're interested in, and what a side hustle needs to be or not. And there's this blurry line that I'm seeing all across the internet and amongst actually a lot of our acquaintances and friends online, that they feel like they need to, one, have a side hustle in general, when I don't think everybody, it's not like a requirement to be a person with a side hustle these days. But I think that what you said was really helpful, because it says to me, you know, like I don't know what it's like to experience your point of view to the kinds of things that I'm working on, as an example. You know, like I know that we have some discussions about it, but the way you just described your experience with your point of view versus, you know, when I'm in the middle of this writing period in my life, it's just like a chapter, no pun intended, of my life that I'm really, really passionate about. I really love writing, and I'm finding something that I've kind of unlocked for myself a little bit here. And, you know, sometimes I know that can probably be a pain in the ass for you when you are interested in doing something else with me. And I, you know, appreciate you for having that empathy and that understanding, I guess, is all I want to say.
Yeah. For me, it was this idea that I could push you and say, well, Mike, you suck. You should do this thing, you know, and like really do the guilt trip path that most people think is appropriate. But for me, it all came down to, this is my interest. This is something I'm going to host on my own anyway. It's these events I'm going to do. And whether or not you join me right now doesn't matter, because at the end of it all, whatever community I'm building, I share that community with all of the people in my network. If you want to host a room with me, if you want to host an event with me, if you want to be there with me, you let me know and I bring you in. That's just how it is. And I'm at a point in my life now where I'm doing all these things on my own. And when I see someone see me from the outside and say, oh my God, Tim, I wish I could be like you. I wish I could be a designer like you. I wish I could have a 3D printer and a laser cutter and have these projects like you do. How do you come up with these designs? The only thing I can say to them is, I took it one day at a time, because I wouldn't be where I am right now with the YouTubing, with everything that I'm doing in my career and everything else, if I didn't practice it every single day. And by sharing that process every day, or however much I'm doing it, people are starting to jump on the bandwagon and they're following my journey. And that's the one thing I'm trying to do for other people. I see Mike is on a journey. I see my fiance is on a journey. Everyone's on a journey. And I'm there to support that journey. I'm the wingman. I'm sitting in the passenger seat. And when I'm driving, they're my wing people, and they're sitting in my passenger seat. I would rather not go on that trip by myself. And so each time you say no, it's okay. You don't have to go to the restaurant with me today, maybe in the future. And so that's the way that I'm seeing these relationships now, that I'm in a car that's moving. I'm driving it, and I open all invitation to everyone around me. And if you want to come into the car and you want to go on this little trip, it's fine. If you don't, that's fine too, because you're on your own path. And if I can't get you to where you want to be, then you need to drive yourself and I need to support you to get there.
Yeah, that's very well said. And I think just building on your metaphor you got here, I think sometimes these paths just naturally kind of come back to each other and weave in and out of each other. So it's not just like you're on your own linear path, I'm on my own linear path. They kind of weave in and out, and you can kind of wave to the other person as you see their journey happening in parallel. So just to go move on to this final mini lesson here, I think this is just a really simple one to end on, and it's be the helpful one in your life. Building on what resonates with people, empathy can help you help those people. By understanding what someone is going through, by understanding their story, you can start to help support their stories from your vantage point. You can lean into their needs and wants. You can be of service to them. You can be the form of support they need more of. By being helpful, you create a positive connection with others, a positive name for yourself, and a sense of satisfaction that you've done your best to help. Tim, when I can, when I can, I try to reach out a hand to help others. This was especially true when I first graduated from college. Would you consider yourself to be a helpful person in the sense that you go out of your way to be of service? And I know we just kind of unlocked and unpacked what you just said about kind of waiting in the wings and being the wingman and supporting people when you can and as you can, and you're on your own journey and they're on their own journey. I would consider you to be a helpful person, but I guess I also thought that you were a driven person and you wouldn't classify yourself as that. So how do you think about being helpful in your own life?
So I would say that for me, the short answer is yes, I love helping people. But when I think about going out of my way to help people and to help others, I no longer reach out a hand to everybody. I'm very selective about the people that I help because my time is getting shorter and shorter and shorter. Each day I have less time to spend on things in my life, even the things that I truly care about. I don't have a lot of time to waste. So to me, what I mean by waste is if someone simply reaches out to me and I've never met this person before and they say, hey, I want to chat with you about your journey through life. To me, if I haven't met you before and you ask me such a vague thing, I usually just let it pass. But if someone asks me enough times, or if I feel like I've had a connection with them before, or if I met them and there was that simple connection, or a friend said, hey, Tim, you should talk to so-and-so, I'll go out, I'll reach out to them. I'll say, hey, this person said I should reach out to you. What's going on? You know, tell me more. But the moment you do that, you're giving time. And as an introverted person, that time leads to a lot of spent energy. So for me, I spend my time in a different way helping others. Now I try and help people in mass. What does that mean? I used to try and help people one-on-one, having these one-on-one meetings, mentoring people, especially minorities who are entering the profession of architecture. I would always give my time to anyone who is a minority trying to get into the field. And I'd sit down with them in person if they were in the local area and guide them. But nowadays, I'm looking at it and saying, how can I do what I love to do in mass? How do I reach a bigger audience or reach a crowd? How do I share the things that people keep asking me about, but share it in a way that people can understand, but understand it in a recording or understand it in a way where I don't need to keep repeating myself? Because as I get older and I help more people, I find that the questions are almost always the same. They always repeat themselves in some way. If you actually get to the essence of a question, you'll find that people ask you the same things in different words. It always comes down to, how did you get licensed in such a short period of time? Or how did you get to the point that you are at now in your career where you're leading projects? How did you get to a point where you were traveling every week? How did you get to a point where you now are starting a side hustle that is actually bringing in passive income? How did you identify your side hustle? How did you identify your passion? How are you doing all the things you're doing with the limited amount of time you have every day? How do you have all these things outside of a full-time job? How are you doing all of this? And so as you start to get to the essence of the questions and you identify these things, it comes down to, how do you actually get to a way of speaking so that you can say the things you say in a short period of time, but record it so you don't have to keep repeating it to many people? That way you can say, hey, you should refer to this thing. Hey, you should refer to that thing. Therefore, it led to this whole idea that I pitched to Mike, which was, let's turn this podcast into a season and let's turn it into a lesson to our younger selves. And let's talk about some of the things that we would tell ourselves, because these are the questions we would have asked ourselves. And now I can refer people to all these things, right? People who say, Tim, I love the way that you speak. Okay, well now refer to the episode about speaking with clarity, finding your voice. And now we have this catalog of material of things we would have taught people. But instead of just teaching one person, I'd rather teach more people. Because if so many people are trying to ask you the same things and you can help the one person, what if you can now help many people by putting it out there and letting those people enjoy the things that you have to say because of the experiences you've had? So now when I think about helping people, that's how I'm thinking about it. How do I do it at scale? How do I reach more of an audience? And not that I want people to follow me, but more that I want to make sure if they're going to ask me that question 10 years from now, that I already have it documented somewhere so that they can just refer to it.
Yeah, I think it's really beautiful what you just said. I think that the overall sentiment there is something that resonates with me a lot, because we're both at this point, I think, in our careers and probably our lives, Tim, where we've been doing this for a few years. We've been trying to help other people, you know, however you want to describe it, on the internet or otherwise, by sharing our stories, sharing our lessons, whether they're life lessons or tactical things or perspectives. And I think that I hadn't really considered it before you said it, but it's more about helping a wider audience by having empathy for that one person, you know, that one person that's asking you those same questions over and over again, almost creating kind of an avatar in my mind of what would that younger person ask me, or that person that's less experienced or that's trying to understand and unlock kind of an idea. How do I have empathy for that person and then start to make things that I can direct them to? And I understand that as we're talking about this, this is starting to go down a little bit of a path of something that, you know, Tim and I specifically deal with, but maybe not everyone does. But I think you could take it in the sense that if you're at the beginning of your journey, have empathy for the fact that the people that are ahead of you and might have experienced other things, that might be older than you, that have just different life journeys, have gained some of that knowledge that can help you. And then on the other end, if you're in the middle part of your life or later stages of your life, think of where you were. You know, that's what this whole series, you hinted at this, but this is where this whole series kind of came from, is having empathy for your younger self, having empathy for the journey that person is on, right? These are lessons that we're trying to share with our younger selves. It's not like I can go back, you know, Marty McFly style in my DeLorean and share this knowledge with my younger self, but I can share it with the person who is in the same shoes that I was, whether they're an architect, a designer, a creative of any kind, somebody else who just happens upon this podcast later in life. It's something that I think is a very interesting way to think about it, just in terms of where can you be helpful? I think if you're in the younger stages of your life, you might be just trying to help however you can. I think of the idea of, if you know just a little bit more than the person before you, you can teach them that thing, right? If you know something that you've learned, you can help teach others. And I advocate for people doing that as much as they can, and not to be sort of annoying about it and not just being a know-it-all, but more of, if you find places that you can be helpful, share that knowledge, share those interests, share those things that excite you or that you're knowledgeable about, because that'll help the next person in line. And it's kind of like pulling people forward with the lessons that you've learned. So just to bring an overview and kind of wrap this up, Tim, the four mini lessons that we've had in this lesson to my younger self, make empathy your superpower, are: one, everyone has their own shit to deal with. Two, the way you react to someone will make you either a leader, a follower, or a roadblock. Three, not everyone cares about the same things you do. And four, be the helpful one in your life. And a closing thought here is that people want to be understood. By being the one to listen and empathize with their story, you're able to do just that. Make empathy the trait that people remember you for. You'll create stronger relationships, develop your network, and build a lasting reputation you can be proud of. The world is in need of more understanding. Make empathy your superpower to connect with those around you and connect them to each other. Thanks, everybody, for listening to this conversation about empathy. Stay tuned for Tim's next and final lesson in the series to his younger self: if you were a book, your actions would be your pen. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for joining us today, guys.
Hey guys, thanks for listening to another episode of Unpacking Design. Check us out anytime at unpackingdesign.com.
And you can also find us on iTunes and anywhere else that you listen to podcasts. Please remember to leave a review and share this podcast with someone you know.